but I figure if I'm doing that for me, I might as well do it for everybody else too.
Okay, do we have everybody on? Are we ready to start?
I don't think anybody's here yet.
Okay, so wait. Doug, are you on?
Yes, good morning, Robert.
Hi, how are you? I was just wondering if there were any follow-up questions to last week. We did quite a bit.
I don't think I do have any.
Okay, you let me know.
Okay.
Hi, good morning, Doug.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, good, thanks. I hope everybody's well. Just spoke to Cal.
Jim, Carolyn, you there?
Morning, Rabbi.
Hey, Jim. Is Nachshon with us? Maybe not yet. Sometimes he joins online. What time do you have there? Oh, all right, so let's start. Okay. Actually, let's conclude, because we just have the last two verses today.
Oh.
So we're going to do the last two verses of Kehelet. We're doing this, I don't know, over 3 years. So it's a nice accomplishment. So he says as follows. Sound is okay? Everybody can hear all right?
Great, thank you.
Yep, it's fine.
Okay, good. Jim, sounds all right? Okay. All right, so we're going on now to the last two verses in the book, which is chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. So King Solomon says as follows. He says, the end of the matter, or the purpose of the matter, depending on which commentary, but I think it means the same point. He says, the end of the matter, all having been heard, God you should fear, and his commandments you should guard, for this is all of man. And the last verse, because all actions God will bring to judgment on anything hidden, if it's good or if it's evil. Okay. So let's examine these verses here. But previously he was telling us in 12:12 that more than what's written here, my son, you should be careful to guard. You can't write everything down. It's impossible. So King Solomon says you have to, more that you're going to hear in life. I mean, don't just think what I'm telling you here. That's all you have to observe to keep. But more, and what the rabbis will teach you and what you'll uncover on your own. He says you should be careful to observe it, to fulfill it. Because making many books, there's no end. Meaning it's impossible to put everything down to ink, so you can't bring that charge and say, well, since it's not written, I don't have to keep it. No, it's impossible. It's impossible to write it all because the ideas are just, they continue to unfold and unravel. And he says the second reason was because it wearies the flesh to make copies of the various works. So two reasons why, he says. But despite that, and you see, that's why I believe he goes on to the next verse, and he says, well, you tell me, why is he bringing in 13? Now he says, the end of the matter is all being heard, God should be feared, and his commands you should keep, for this is all of man. So what would seem to be a problem? What are the issues that you could detect from the verse?
Well,
Yep.
Just wondering if he means that we should just keep everything and just do what we're supposed to do and really not worry about anything else, because everything else is hidden, and what we should concern ourselves with is the most important thing, the main thing, and that the man's duty, so to speak, is, as he said, that he should be completely with his man, do everything that's right.
Well, what would be the problem with the verse, though? I agree. That's what he's saying. I agree.
Yeah.
But in following up 12:12, what does 12:13 is a problem that's brought up?
Well, that confused me also, because there's a lot of books to read. In other words, to know, to learn, and still there's like a contradiction in a sense.
What's that contradiction?
The contradiction is it's weariness to the flesh. Too much learning, too much doing.
No, that's not a contradiction.
No?
No.
But then I'm not clear.
Yeah, I'm trying to point you to the fact that there is a conflict between 12 and 13. So I want you to look at both verses and tell me what the conflict is.
Rabbi?
Yes. So the conflict is what exactly?
The conflict is that 12 seems to be, at least the way that we discussed it last time, seems to be saying, no, you can't possibly learn it all. But 13 is saying, but you're responsible for knowing and keeping all the commandments. It's almost like saying, well, you can't possibly know it all, but you're responsible to live up to it.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. I don't think he's telling you that you're responsible for more than what you can learn in your life. That would be completely unjust. I mean, he's saying in 12 that you can't possibly write it all down. So you can just explain 13 to me, and that, a new point, that you should keep the commands, or whatever you learn. But you're on the path, but there's a stronger statement.
Well, also, and I don't know if this is where you're headed, but in 11 we talked about the words of the wise and so forth. Wisdom and commandments are two different things. A person could just strictly keep the commandments, but not be necessarily wise in terms of thinking through situations and personal interactions and philosophy and that kind of thing. And so that seems to be what 11 and 12 are referring to, but then in 13 it seems to be switching over to halacha. The whole thing is about keeping halacha, and that's your entire duty. But what happened to the philosophy, self-improvement, character development, so forth?
Well, the mitzvahs address all that. Returning a lost item, things of that nature. I mean, all the mitzvahs are addressing every aspect of man. So let's think go ahead.
If somebody just kept the commandments, then in fact their character would develop and improve and so forth.
Well, the way to keep the commands, Rabbi Chaim once quoted Rashi in Deuteronomy, that if a person does the commands without understanding why, it's useless. So the commands really have to be performed based on an understanding. I think one of the commentators says it over here. Yes, this was Yeah. For example, Rashi says at the end of 14 that every matter will be brought to judgment, whether good or whether evil. And what does Rashi say? The last Rashi in the book, he says, whether you do an action of good or evil. And he says, even if you stumble while doing a commandment, for example, if you give charity to a poor person publicly, indicating that the person didn't understand that the charity is supposed to be something which gives the person dignity again. But doing it publicly is the opposite of objective. You're doing it for your own glory. So you see that Rashi is intimating that there's a correct understanding of the command. I mean, I won't discount that if a person just goes through the actions, that might engender certain feelings or notions that can also benefit him. I mean, that's why a command is not merely to think about a concept, but to physically perform actions. It's insufficient that a person just thinks or values that all the commands, yes, I value all the commands, all great. But if he doesn't lift his finger to perform, so there's a disconnect between his mind and his actions. And that's really the barometer of conviction in a human being, is when you have the thought fall through an action. If there's a thought, but it's not fall through an action, so the person's really not convinced of the truth of it. I mean, it's true. I mean, he talks about the philosophy too, but I mean, that's the mitzvahs are all to guide a person, but he has to understand what he's doing. Now, but I'll tell you the problem that I was trying to drive at was that if you're telling me that in 12:12 that it's impossible to write everything down, so how could you tell me in 13 everything has been heard? Right? It's like, you just told me, you can't possibly write everything down. So how's he saying, 13, the end of the matter is that after all has been heard, all the words of the wise, how can you say that? You just told me, you can't write everything down.
I thought at that time everything was passed on from person to person.
Yeah. I mean, the written, at this time, it was the oral law was not yet written. But they definitely had notes, too. I mean, they had the written Torah. They had the five books, and they had the prophets up to King Solomon's time when this book was written. But it just struck me as being, seemed to be a conflict. He's warning you in 12:12 that he's telling you, my son, meaning the reader, don't think that you just, you know, whatever's written here, that's it. Nope, we couldn't possibly cover everything because you can't write everything down. To make many books, there's no end to what can be written. So what must he mean when he says in 13, the end of the matter is all has been heard? And we also have to say, what do you mean all has been heard? So I think he means to say the primary concepts is what the in terms of life, the primary issues. I mean, the whole book of Kohelet was about what? It was man trying to attain happiness. And what was Kohelet doing? What was King Solomon doing throughout the whole book?
Telling you that the systems of men don't work.
Exactly. He explored and tested all the different views that people have. See, that's what I think he means at a kol nishma. I mean, everything has been heard, meaning we had a question we started with. What's the great, how does man attain happiness? And what do? We explored all of man's assumptions. Oh, was it wealth? Was it happiness? Was it drunkenness? Was it anger? Was it giddiness? All the different attitudes. And what about all the different actions, assuming wealth, and but you leave it to somebody and who didn't even work for it, you don't even know. And he talks about all the despair that a person's going through, that there's no justice over here. And he talked about people's assumptions that, you know, the dead, you know, everybody's gonna die, whether you're rich, whether you're poor, whether you're righteous, whether you're evil. So what's the use? Why did I waste my time becoming wise if I'm also gonna be dead like another person? I mean, he vocalized the opinions, the wrong assumptions. So he's doing all this because there's a underlying feeling that the entire world pretty much has. And that underlying feeling is that when you're presented with the Torah, person pushes back and says, I'll find an alternative way to find happiness. That's what a person is doing. All the restrictions and all the laws and you know, all these halachas and everything that the rabbis came up with, these thousands of laws that govern all the laws of the Torah. So the rabbis were given license to set up protective fences in order that the Torah shouldn't be violated. So this becomes a little bit overwhelming for some, you know, for many people. And then they say, you know, I'll find an alternative way to be happy. And they come up with all these different assumptions. So King Solomon, throughout the book, took, you know, he tore apart each one. He vocalized it many times. As we said, many times he's vocalizing it. It sounds like it's his opinion. So we said that was his method in order to catch the ear of the reader. He would say something. He didn't say it was somebody else's opinion first that he was going to break down. He just says something, and it sounds like he's saying it. That's why the rabbis made a statement that they desired to store the book away, meaning they knew that the book was true. But the desire to store it away, we discussed this, was that people are going to have a misconception because they weren't really studying it. And they thought that this was just like these statements, these isolated statements, is really conclusionary. But that's why they said that they didn't hide the book, because it ends on the right note, which are these notes right here, these two verses. But what I'm trying to pronounce here is that people will have this feeling that, you know, I don't need the system, and I'll find an alternative method to work with the world to achieve happiness. So what King Solomon tells you is that after all has been heard, meaning after all these arguments and all these discussions about what people thought were they were going to do and how they were going to achieve happiness, he says, no, God should be feared and his commands should be observed, because this is all of man. What does he mean? What's the answer that you can give to a person like that he's addressing in his book that would really sit well with the person, and he'll agree with King Solomon?
That is that the person who will be happy is the person who is complete, who has fulfilled his purpose for living.
Right, true. But the person thought, I don't need the Torah, I'll find some other means.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I don't want to make it too simplistic, but if we follow Hashem, I think that we're being taught that if we follow Hashem, we won't have to worry about anything else. Everything will be taken care of.
That's true. But I think it's trying to show from a trial and error approach. Because that's what the whole book was about, right? It was trial and error, and he went through everything, and he explored it, and they said, look, you know, all these different things you assume were true or not. Mm-hmm. So I believe what he's trying to tell you is that there's something underlying that approach that people have. First of all, there's the underlying feeling, I'll find an alternative path to happiness. But that is based on another error, and that is that the two systems are not related, meaning what I'll do with my life, the natural world, that's something which has its own way of functioning, and it has nothing to do with Torah. So even though I don't follow the Torah, I'm living in the physical natural world, and I'll find happiness that way. But he's trying to tell you that that's not possible, because really God made everything. When he says that after all has been heard, meaning when we tested everything in the physical world, it ends up that it all comes back to the truths in the Torah and all the mitzvahs. That's what he's telling you here. That after all is said and done, after we assume, we let people go, we gave them a lot of you know, what do they call that? The slack on the leash.
Yeah.
So we gave him a lot of slack. You know, give him enough rope to hang yourself with. Go ahead, try out all these things, and he tested it in his book, in Koheles, and he says, you see, if we've come full circle after all these main considerations about people who are going to be happy, after all has been, you know, said and done, it really complies with the system of the Torah. That means he's telling people that the system of the Torah is not something which is different than the natural world. It basically is telling you this is the map of your natural life.
Right, and it's been time tested.
Yeah. So he's trying to tell you that the very assumption that people had, it has been proven to be incorrect. There are not two systems, it's one system. The creator of the world and the system of the Torah is one, and he made one as a complement. And that's why he says at the end of the verse, because this is all of man, meaning, what does it mean, this is all of man? What does that mean? Just plain translation.
This is all that man needs.
No.
It concerns man.
I think it means that when we say this is all of man, that means this is man's design.
Oh.
Man has been designed this way. So the very man himself is really the synthesis of those two worlds. I mean, he's actually showing you that you had an assumption that there's a natural way to live, and that's going to be, and that's the, you know, completely divergent from a Torah system. There's Torah, that's religion, and then there's nature. And that's how scientists today view it. You know, God forbid that a scientist would say the word God. No, we're purely studying, you know, the world. Science is a different thing than religion, which is completely wrong. So, how does he show that? He shows that by saying the words, this is all of man, meaning man is a synthesis of a natural design and a soul. So King Solomon might be saying a very brilliant statement here, that in our exploration, in our treatment of people's assumptions, that there's two worlds, a religious world called Torah and a natural world, and you could pick either one, and, you know, it's possible that you could be completely happy in the natural world. And that's what people thought. I don't need all the Torah system. I don't need all the laws. I'll just go after what I want. So he said, all right, let's explore it. And after all is said and done, he shows you at the end, no, you really have to fear God, the one that created it. And really his commands are going to allow you to adjust yourself to how the world works. So the commands are not just in a, you know, an isolated, encapsulated sphere, closed off from the world. Just the opposite. They're complementary. And how do we see that the natural world and the world of religion is really complementary? You have a being that has both. So God created both, and there could be a harmony. So man really represents the combination of those two worlds. So really it's one world. It's true, man has senses, he's physical, and God's brilliance, he saw this is the best way to give a being an opportunity to arrive at happiness and attain an eternal life and really enjoy wisdom. So it's true that man has the physical, but don't think that, I mean, that's the big problem I think people have in life, and that's really what this book is telling you, that people really run to the sensual. Whatever I see, whatever I feel, whatever, you know, that's it. They don't think that there's something beyond that. But the fact is that, like you said before, Rivka, that if a person does live properly, you have a whole system of providence that can come into play and affect a person positively in a system and go along. So I believe that's this pasuk, this verse 13 is really very, very crucial, because it sums up what the book was about and how it comes full circle and what the real underlying feeling was of people that he was addressing throughout the book. Everybody see that?
Right. Could I add something also, Rabbi?
Yeah, well, just one second. Let me just make sure that's just where the point is clear. Mm-hmm. Any questions on it? Is it clear?
I have a question, but Rivka can ask hers first.
Oh, thank you. No, it's just a statement that I wanted to make. We read yesterday's Parsha with Mishpatim, And I had a question about if the people die and so on, will they be returned to life again? And if they return to life again, if there's illnesses, people will still pass away. But the rabbi was saying that in Mishpatim there is a passage that says that if you worship Hashem, and He will provide all the blessings you need. It's in Rashi. In 23:25, it says it, and that this goes over to what we're saying here, and what Kahalas is saying, that we don't have to really worry. Everything is basically taken care of. We could follow. We don't have to follow science, because science is halacha. Science is what Hashem provided. He made it. We don't have to worry about anything. We have
right.
to just do the right thing. Thank you.
Yeah. One second.
I thought that there were no guarantees for even the righteous.
Well, you have rules, and what the specific cases will be, you're right. There may be something the righteous person does, he's getting punished here in order that his next world is completely perfect. But what God is referring to over here in 23:25, he says you should serve God, and he'll bless your bread and your water, and he'll remove sickness from your midst. So he's talking about the nation. But that doesn't mean that if a person in a certain case did something wrong, that he deserves a punishment.
Isn't it also such that the tsunami doesn't know the difference unless the person is under God's special hashkacha, that the tsunami takes the righteous and the unrighteous all at the same time?
My understanding is that it's only if he did something wrong, like King David says, that he says seven evils will befall the righteous, but he'll be saved from all of them. So what do you mean seven evils will befall? I mean, people have free will, and there are natural calamities going on, and this is God's will, that people express their free will and all. But if this person is completely righteous and he's in harm's way, so he may be in the path of danger, but God will protect him. And there's no shortage of God's abilities. If a person does not deserve something, he's not going to be hurt. That's what King David says. Seven things might befall him, meaning many things can happen in a person's life. But the person is totally righteous. Not one of his bones will be broken, is what King David says.
But then, isn't the concept of a totally righteous person kind of a limiting case? Where if we looked across history, we would probably only find a handful of such people.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a few, of course. But my point is that there's no shortage for God's ability to make sure that a person is not deserving of something, that he shouldn't get it. God is completely just. You could have nations of people that are completely off the path. They think God is a completely wrong thing, so there's no providence whatsoever, and when a tsunami comes, they'll all be lost. Because none of them were deserving of it. They had the completely wrong concept of God. You got a person who's is righteous to the point that he doesn't deserve to die at this moment. So God will make sure he's delayed or whatever it's going to be. Many, like the rabbis say, God has many messengers. He has many ways to achieve, and his eye is on everybody. He knows exactly what each one deserves. Okay. Was that your question? Was there another question, Doug?
I have another question. So if we're saying that verse 13 says that the end of the book is the real way to happiness is to fear God and keep His commandments, then why don't we see an entire group of happy people on the earth?
You don't see them?
I see occasional happy people, but if I were to, and this is just my observation, if I were to look at the entire universe of people that I understand seem to be following this path, I wouldn't be able to draw a broad brush and say, oh yeah, they're all very, very happy. In other words, kind of like we do in Proverbs, I'm looking to say, okay, if it says, well, do this, and this is the way to happiness, then I'm looking out in the world saying, okay, do we see people that are doing this, and in fact that they are, you know, completely happy? And again, my observations are limited, but I don't necessarily see that. I'm curious as to whether you or others do.
Well, I see when people are involved in study, and a lot of times they can get derailed, but, you know, like Maimonides says, a person's undoing is really, most of the time, it's his own actions, self-inflicted wounds. So that's going to happen. So in as much as a person, and I see people that are intelligent and live properly, so and they sometimes they do have problems, but even when they're with the problems, they, you know, they deal with it properly. It could derail them a bit, but for the most part, you know, people I speak to, whether it's a man or a bechet, stories I hear from Machniweis about conversations with Rabbi Moskowitz, you know, people that are involved in, you know, they have the right attitude in terms of, you know, money. A good friend of mine, David Markowitz, like very settled, seems to be content. I never see the guy agitated. The guy loves to learn, whether it's Plato, he's quoting me something from Plato or something in philosophy, in the Talmud, whatever it is. And yeah, he gets together with individuals and learns with them and helps them out. And they seem to be, you know, living and enjoying that. Of course, there's going to be certain hurdles in terms of work, but that challenges are okay. A person could welcome a challenge. And it's, if a person has the wrong attitude, it could be a person that's very religious and living properly and loves wisdom, but there could be a part of his personality where his desire for money is a little bit, you know, uncontrolled. So he's frustrated when he gets into that part of the day when he's working, and really he's going to have to learn to tame that. That doesn't mean in other parts of his day is not content and happy. So I think, you know, God gives us a number of decades because a lot of us need that many years to work on the various aspects. The people who are very erratic, I see, somebody I know specifically is like his emotions, he can control himself because, you know, he's got an image to maintain. But sometimes when he's in close quarters with just, you know, friends and acquaintances or people he doesn't care much about, he can be very, very erratic emotionally. And you see there's some turmoil going on. But this is the same person that's, you know, he's well into his 60s, you know, multimillionaire, and he's not satisfied. So you see something is there, you see there's a tumult going on in a person like that. So I could definitely say that there, I see a distinction in the quality of life between people who are following the philosophy of Torah and people who are not. I see even with us, you know, we get together year after year in this group. So, you know, Jim has a question, you have a question, and we're discovering, and you know, during this time, you know, what could be better? You know, opening your eyes to see something new, some brilliant insight. I know that's something which is a highlight of my day, you know, or if the case is, you know, the month, when, you know, sometimes you don't see something, you know, that brilliant that often, but you always want to. You pray that you will see new ideas, new great insights all the time. And when you do, it's like that the glare of the brilliance of that insight overshadows other things that you're pursuing. I think Maimonides talks about that when people see certain ideas, it's like, you know, they're flashes in the night. And it's very far, you know, few and far between. But Moses, it was like a constant flash, when meaning to say the ideas that he saw, the brilliance of the wisdom that he was exposed to. So he describes it as that type of a, you know, just catches the attention like a bright light when you see new ideas. But I would say that if the person is living the right philosophy in all areas, he's going to be. Like, you know, the Birchas HaMazon, the Torah commands us to say a blessing after we have, we're satisfied from having bread. And in there, This is one of the statements at the very end says, I was once a lad and now I'm old, and I never saw a righteous person that was really without what his knees were.
Right, that's a beautiful.
Right, I never saw like a righteous person that was, he had to be really righteous, you know? But again, you got to keep in mind that sometimes people shoot themselves in the foot, even if they're living great in other areas. So it's a hard thing to assess also. It really is. We don't know all the inner workings, the emotions that people have, the problems that people make in their minds or real problems. So it's a difficult thing to assess, really. But you do see that at the end of the Birchas HaMazon, that one of the rabbis there did say that. He says, you know, Nar Hayisi V'gam Zakanti. I was once young, and now I'm very old. And he says, but throughout my life, V'lo Reisi Tzadik Nezav, I never saw a real righteous man that was without. He was in pain that he didn't have something. And that has to do with your desires. Meaning a person can have everything and still be anxious because he doesn't have enough. He's crazy. You know, a person could have like billions of dollars and still be and wants, like, you know, what's his name? The guy who's
Madoff?
Hathaway. What's his name? Berkshire Hathaway? What's his name? Yeah, the man is still living in a $36,000 home, so he's making all this money. So you wonder what's going on in his mind, really. What type of happiness? There's something still driving him. There's something unsatisfied still. So, but then you see people that have, like King David says, he says, don't make me poor and don't make me rich. Just give me my daily bread. King David said this. One of the wisest men. He didn't want riches. Why? He saw clearly. You don't take it with you, number one. Number two, with the more wealth, like it says in Pirkei Avos, the more anxiety you have. You increase your possessions, you increase your anxiety. He didn't want that. He was interested in pursuing wisdom. He saw that as being the greatest enjoyment, like Socrates and Plato and Einstein and Newton. I mean, these are people we should look at and say, you know, look how they were so enamored with their pursuits. Look, these people were at the peak of satisfaction.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I remember, I don't know if you recall, it was some years ago, and I was saying something to you in reference to happiness, and you said, everybody is really happy. It's how you look at it. It's how you look at things. And you quoted me a very simplistic way of looking at something. And you say, if I have a dent in my fender, it's not going to bother me because the car is still running. But I look at somebody else's new, rich, shiny car that's perfect in all ways, and there's no dents, then maybe I'll become unhappy. But it only will happen if I look at what somebody else has. But basically what I have is fine, so I'm happy. So it's a question of looking at things, at the attitude that you have, and this is how you present it to me then, which I still remember. So I think it's the way we basically are happy and we basically have what we need if we just live life properly.
And I think I'd have to withdraw that because I don't agree that you are happy. That person has to work on that.
Oh, no, you didn't say not to work on it. You have to work on it.
Okay. But yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, the relativistic lifestyle that most people lead with the comparing themselves is going to introduce there's always somebody who has something more. So again, the philosophy of the Torah is telling you, and like getting back to Doug's point earlier, though, so it says to do the mitzvos, but yes, the mitzvos guide us because they're correcting our views on all areas.
Right.
So that's important.
We have to look at what we should be grateful for, not what we don't have.
We have to look at reality and see where happiness comes from. That has to be analyzed. People don't do that. That's not taught.
Well, the bracha is in the morning.
Yeah, I'm saying more than that. A real study. That's what Koheles is all about. Koheles is a real in-depth study as to taking people's assumptions and putting them under the microscope and then testing them out. Does it really work in the world or not? So it's something which people have to do, and they don't. Luckily, we had the chance to do it. Now, yeah, Doug, do you have a follow-up on the question?
Yeah, so I'm troubled by this arena because, you know, if I read in the news, if I'm reading it correctly, we've got Orthodox Jewish groups world and say, well, the only people that are really happy are the people that are, you know, following the Torah and keeping the mitzvos. It seems like there are people who are doing that who are not happy, and people who are not doing that who are happy.
I don't believe that people who are not doing that. Who are the people that are not doing it that are happy?
Well, you mentioned Warren Buffett. I've listened to Warren Buffett speak, and I think Warren Buffett's enjoying his life and doing what he wants to do.
Yeah, don't believe it so much. These guys are very good at controlling them and presenting an image of themselves. You have no idea what is going on, you know, when he's not on stage.
Yeah, but you're taking the position that, well, if they're not following it, or it sounds like you're taking the position that if they're not following it, then there must be something wrong with them that they're not showing. It's almost like...
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, because if you're not following the design of how God made a person to be happy, you can't be happy.
Yeah, but then if you go out and look and observationally see that people are, then it seems like instead of saying, okay, how can that actually be, you're just saying, well, they're not really happy, they're just faking it.
No, I'm saying that when a person is under the spotlight for those few minutes, you're seeing, first of all, it's a very myopic view. You're seeing a very small part of that person's day. When you see people out at a dinner and they're drinking and they're eating and this and that, that's also a very small part of the day. And I'm not denying that these people that are completely barbaric, that they, of course, they're enjoying their meat. It tastes fantastic. They're hungry. They're feeling full. They're drinking. They're getting a little buzzed. So there's definitely sensual pleasure. But pleasure doesn't mean happiness. Then they go on with their regular day, and they're facing all different decisions that they, you don't know what they screwed up on their mortgage, or since they are that way, and they're always looking to unleash their emotions. A person like that, who I see is very loud during a dinner, I know right away that he's having a tumultuous life in other areas, because if he's the type of person that is looking to outlet emotions, as, you know, to really fully satisfy an emotion, and not to do it with restraint, so then that's going to express itself in other areas. He'll make brazen decisions because he's doing it emotionally. And the people who are religious that you quote that are in Israel and they're fighting, I don't call them religious. I don't say that they're following the Torah at all.
That's right.
It's craziness what they're doing. It's not Torah.
That's right. And it's a sin in the sense because they're presenting themselves as Orthodox.
Yep.
And it's against Hashem. It's against God, they're just desecrating God. They're saying, I'm Orthodox. Orthodox meaning,
yep, that's true,
everything correctly, and they're doing everything wrong. That's not Orthodox. They're anything but.
Yep, not Orthodox.
Totally not.
But I'm saying, Doug, it's important that we don't just look at a segment, a small component, a minuscule, you know, part of the person's life when they're prepared to be speaking publicly. You can't take that as being a sampling of what their basic life is. I don't think that's an accurate thing to do. I think what we have to do is really, you know, look at the people that over a long range. You know, I was looking the other day on the internet about the quotes from Einstein, and that took time. He was involved in thought. Something pulled him towards that life, and all the writing and all the discoveries, there must have been something which kept him there that was really very, you know, enjoyable. But you see, it also he had a certain morality too. He had a certain sensibility, a certain you know, relationship with God. Would, if he had followed the Torah, would he have been a happier person? Of course.
Am I correct that amongst Orthodox Jewish, I'm not picking on Orthodox Jewish, but just because this is what we're talking about and it happens to be kind of the test group, amongst Orthodox Jewish youth and getting into the teen years, that there is a problem with teens wanting to turn away from the Torah path?
I can't speak generally on that at all. I just don't have enough information. I can only imagine that the time when obligation comes upon a person, there's going to be rebelliousness, and you know, generally, and especially during that age where you're rebelling against parents, and it's a very uneasy state, and you're worried about peer approval. It's a very big emotion. That's that plagues a teen. It's a natural thing that happens because you're now getting an identity. You're now concerned about how you're viewed. You're starting to like the opposite sex, and there's a very big concern there too. So you have a lot going on, but I'm sure that there's rebelliousness against that too, because a lot of the schools just don't teach properly. They tell you to do a lot, and they don't give you any philosophy. But what about that?
Well, my thought being, if this path is the path that brings happiness, then why would people who are in it for whatever reason, either born in it or converted into it or, you know how to wander into it, why would they stray?
Yeah, well, I think the main reason is because they're not being taught the philosophy. I'll give you an example. I was teaching fourth grade about 20 years ago, and there was one kid in the class, this guy Donnie. And these are 9-year-old boys, right? Like 26 of them. And he was the most, you know, athletic and boisterous, you know, kid, you know, cute kid, very energetic. And, you know, recess is the highlight of the day. You know, you're getting out from being in this, you know, lined up classroom, all the desks, equally spaced, having to conform to, an adult, you know, and when you really want to just be playing. That's what you've been doing your whole life until you entered school. And so we started learning, and, you know, I would work with them in terms of how to ask questions, how to figure out problems on their own. That was really what I was focusing on, how they should think and how they can ask, you know, certain questions, and just the clues can give them the answer. And one day, towards the end of the year, I gave a question, and you never saw a kid's face light up as much as this kid Donnie. He'd be the last one I would have thought that would really get into wanting to say, I figured it out. And he jumped out of a seat with a smile on his face, and he had the answer perfectly. I'm just saying, giving an example of how, even at that young age, if you get them on the right path where they start to use their head and they start figuring out things, they start getting a very intense enjoyment, which, even if the person is the one that just is the most opposite you think, that his, all of his energies are going into, you know, sensual activities, sports and wrestling and whatever it is, that very same person could take those energies and find an intense satisfaction if they're taught properly. And I think that's probably the problem, that the schools are not giving the philosophy, they're not training the kids how to think. It's more memorization, regurgitation. My friend told me yesterday that, Rabbi Pinchas Rosenthal, right?
Yes, I do.
Yes, so he was in town, and he was telling me how his kids in the school, and he disagreed with the rabbi what they're teaching. They're doing this Talmudic area, which is like so abstract, so unrelated to daily life, it's just boring the heck out of his kid. And he told the principal that, you know, what changes is, so you see. And then the principal, the funny thing is, it's he's of his same, you know, he's a peer. So, you know, there are a lot of issues that are causing that. It's not Judaism. It's what people are doing with it. The people that are running the schools and setting up the curriculums and, you know, there's that I think is really the problem. But if you would take the kid and teach him how to think and show him and train his mind, he'd jump out of the seat like this little, you know, 9-year-old kid that I had 20 years ago. That's just an example of how they can really be excited and they can enjoy it. And imagine if they were trained from that young age, as they get older, they would have even more and more abilities, and they'd really enjoy it. They'd really start finding satisfaction in the area that can give them those happiness, meaning the pursuit of wisdom, as opposed to what the world is teaching today, even in the Jewish, you know, communities. You know, go after money, go after fame, give a lot of money, you become a person very famous at a dinner, you know. So all these things is what people are being taught, and it's unfortunate, but it's not the system. It's what people are doing with it.
I agree with you, Rabbi. I've seen that.
I think that's a problem, Doug.
100%. And it's also personality, I think. I remember Rav Miller Dessal, may he rest in peace. He has said, no matter who a person is, you could say a person is Orthodox, a person is religious, a person so-called following the Torah. But before he could be any of those things, first he's a person. He has his own personality, his own emotions, his own desires, and he has to be in constant control of that. I mean, I know a very religious boy who was in yeshiva. I came from a very religious home. He was in yeshiva from day one. He grew up to go into drugs and eventually passed away. I know another boy who went into yeshiva also, and he grew up and he went into being into the gay community.
Right. All right.
All these incidentals.
Yep.
There's never a general rule. Each person is unique and has to control what he has to control within himself, and then he can be called Orthodox if he follows everything. Otherwise, Orthodox is just being used in a way that's an abomination to Hashem.
Yep.
I have one last question.
Yeah, and I think Jim had one too. I think I heard Jim perk up. Go ahead, Doug. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, Jim, are you there?
Yeah.
Did you want to say something?
Yeah, but I can wait. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, because I'm going to switch to a slightly different subject. Go ahead.
Rabbi, are we saying then, it seems like we must be saying anyway, that this is not something that can be arrived at inductively?
That what cannot be induced?
That we cannot, through inductive logic, come to the conclusion that the Torah life produces happiness.
You mean because King Solomon put it through a trial and error in the physical world?
But because Doug seems to suggest, and we seem to be saying, that that we can't actually see it in the physical world. For example, if Warren Buffett is happy, we can't know it. He seems to be happy, but we're going to assume that he can't be happy because we already know deductively that he can't be happy if he's living a Torah.
I don't agree with that. I'm saying that there's many facets, many aspects that you don't have. That doesn't mean that you can't learn what, you know, the full life of a certain person. If you study them and you see them, then you do have the facts. So you, by looking at something, sometimes you have all the factors, and sometimes you don't. I mean, I was using the, you know, example too to show how, you know, you have both sides. If you're living properly, you have. I was citing certain individuals I know that have. They appear to me. I mean, they have, you know, very content. You know, they're satisfied. They're easy, even keeled. They're not erratic in behavior, and then I see the opposite. So you can use the, you know, what you see to come to conclusions. But not all the time do you have all the facts. I'm just thinking, because what Doug's case was a very small sampling of this guy's life. Let's explore him. You want it? Let's take him apart and see how he's been living his entire life and what he's been doing with his free time, and then you'll have more information. But just to base it on a few minute presentation, that's just too small of a sampling. I think, you know, a scientific approach is to have, you know, you repeat the experiment over and over again. When you have the same conclusion every time, then you know you discovered a principle. But there's plenty of area that you can also, you know, deduce and induce as well. I mean, even in the physical world. I know I take a hard substance, I throw it against something very, you know, fragile, it's going to break it. I don't have to do it in order to know that, because I've got experience enough already. So I can make induction. So it's both. But what, were you driving at something else, Jim?
No. Understand that point. It seems like we want... it's not that I disagree with the conclusion, mind you, but it seems like we're trying to approach it from two different ways. One seems to be through induction, and one seems to be through deduction. And we don't have enough evidence, it seems, to make an inductive conclusion. And so whenever it seems not to fit the facts, then we're just throwing our hands up and saying, well, we don't know everything because it didn't come out the way we wanted. At least that's how it appears. That's sort of fine. I mean, mind. But then I just think we almost have to say it can't be arrived inductively because we don't know all the things that are going on.
What do you mean specifically? What can't be arrived at inductively? What's the example or the lesson in specific?
Well, that the Torah life is producing this happiness, and it's the only way to achieve it.
All right, so you'd be more satisfied if we had more examples.
I'm not looking for an inductive argument, personally. That's the one that we seem to be going with. We seem to be looking at four examples, but
that's not inductive. Inductive means you're using your mind to arrive at a conclusion.
No, that's deductive. Inductive logic means we look for examples and come to a conclusion from them, but we seem to be writing off certain examples a priori because we don't have all the information, so then we assume that it just there's a reason it doesn't fit our...
Well, wouldn't you agree that you can't make a statement about a person's life? A guy's 70 years old, you can't make an assessment based on a 5-minute speech?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm just saying that, but you would be able to make an assessment if you looked at a good majority of his life.
Yes, but you at least implied that you know that he's not happy, but you also don't have the sampling.
So I'm saying that you can't, say that just because he presented himself this way, that's a, it's proof. But I did say also that the fact that the guy is not living based on principles that God has mapped out for the human species, so he can't have real happiness. Yes. That would apply to anybody.
Well, that's a priori reasoning, though, isn't it?
Well, it's because we know from experience, we know that there's certain things that satisfy people and certain things that aggravate people. Or it's based on knowledge. It's not I'm not just talking in the wind.
No, Rabbi, I don't mean to imply that at all. I'm just making the distinction. I'm not criticizing your method.
No, it's all right. We're talking freely here. Don't worry about that. What's the distinction?
Well, Doug seems to be looking for some inductive proof, and it seems that we can't draw that proof effectively.
Because he's saying from experience, when we look around the world... But I was saying it was incorrect label, that to say these people are religious and how come they're not happy, I was saying, no, they aren't religious. So would that be a safe step? And then if we look at people that I'm giving examples that I know personally that are upholding the right moral character and they are charitable and they do learn and they enjoy teaching others, so that's a real religious person. And then I say these people I do see are content. They are satisfied.
Rabbi, I think the concern is that if a person takes the position that, okay, what King Solomon said is true, absolutely, you know, the only way you're going to be happy is to follow his life, then any time you go out and look at somebody else, then the person automatically interprets whatever they observe to fit into that already determined conclusion.
Okay, that would be a wrong approach. Then you just try to defend King Solomon, which is wrong. But we're reading this statement of his after having spent 3 years going through the book. And we explored together the different emotions that people have and all the base desires. And then all of the feelings that they had. Now they had all this money, but now I'm going to die and leave it over to somebody. And he was criticizing that type of a thing because you're not even around. Why are you concerned? So he and all the specifics. So it's not like we're, you know, starting from the end of the book and now saying, oh, King Solomon says something, now he's got to be right and we'll just force the case. I mean, aren't we well enough, you know, versed with, you know, what he said throughout the book to agree with him?
I'm not certain I completely agree with him.
Okay.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Yeah.
The question is, how do we define happiness? So somebody could be very happy if their whole life was spent trying to make money, and they've developed this, and they've made a tremendous amount of money. Now they have this money, and they feel secure, and they feel content. Happiness to one person could be not the same happiness to somebody else.
I don't agree with that, because the human being is one design. And once you define what happiness is, then you'll have to meet up. I mean, you're right. You have to define what is happiness.
Right.
Happiness is when the person is, his energies are being satisfied, when there's not a conflict. You know, there's a number of things that will bring a person to happiness. And even if he has all that, but if he's not pursuing his intelligent side, so he feels a certain emptiness, that's when people become very, you know, people who are very much into the arts and they make so much, then they make endowments. Because now there's a part that they need to satisfy that they're morally correct. Because now they're just going after money that's too empty for them. So I don't agree that, you know, what makes one person happy can make the other person upset. That then you're saying there's many types of human beings.
No, I don't mean to make somebody upset. I'm saying to be very simplistic about it. Somebody could be happy because they have the money and they're content. Another person, if they all the money in the world, won't give me happiness because I have a sick child.
Okay.
I mean, there again, this, I think...
That's specific circumstances, though.
Yeah, making the comparison within ourselves. I mean, for myself, I know when I have a lot of work to do, I'm very unhappy, Captain. I just, you know, I want to get my work out of the way so I can be...
Well, that has to do with what values, what person puts priority on in life. Person has to learn what is really of value, and they have to put things in perspective, and that, you know, there's emotions that have to be trained.
Right. But orthodoxy is, being orthodox and following the Torah is the basic, is the foundation for everything.
Well, that's what Doug is questioning. He's saying it's too simplistic just to follow, and because King Solomon said it, therefore, a person might start to just, you know, you pry everything up, you know, a person's going to definitely be happy if he does X, Y, and Z. And we're just trying to talk honestly here. Doug, can you actually paint that, you know, give me an example in terms of where your question is coming from?
My question is coming from when I look around and the travels that I do and people I talk to poor communities and non-poor communities, I don't see that universally people that are involved in Torah are happy. And I don't see that people who aren't involved in Torah are universally unhappy.
Okay.
And so I'm just looking at this saying, gee, if that's what King Solomon said, this is it. You know, it's kind of black and white. If you're here, you're happy. If you're not, you're not. That's not what I observe when I talk to people.
Well, could it be that the people who are not following Torah, that may not be true? Meaning, you may meet some guy who's a Christian in the middle of Arkansas, and this guy gives his kid good morals. The kids are respectful. He has a loving wife that's loyal to him and devoted. He's at a job where it's very low stress. Ends up, he's really following a good amount of Torah philosophy, even though he is not even aware of what Torah is.
Exactly.
And you could have somebody who's, like I say, you know, a person who's, you know, he's attending temple three times a day, and keeping the Sabbath and all these different things, but there are certain other things in his life that are completely awry in terms of his emotional makeup or conflicts that he has that he's unhappy. And that happens a lot. So we have to really be careful to strip away what's self-induced and not call that, you know, Torah. That has nothing to do with Torah. So we can't blame Torah if we see people like that are quote-unquote religious as being, you know, how come they're not happy? Well, there's a lot that they're doing that's it's not Judaic in value. Whereas a person could not be Jewish at all, and he could have that. And then we have to look at it case by case, I guess. But I would say the rule is that if a person, you know, we all have the same makeup. And what, you know, low stress is better for a person than high stress. So across the board, every person who's got a lower stress job, and when he's got, you know, people are respectful to him at home, that's another thing that across the board is going to add to the person's, his tranquility, his happiness. And a person that has more free time than less free time is going to have more of an easygoing demeanor. So I would say that's a constant. Well, I guess you'll have to see in each case, you know, where it pans out, where it doesn't. But I think those rules are true. And I think if a person's following the Torah philosophy, where he's told how to treat people and how to speak to people and how to deal with money and all these different areas, his emotions are being kept in check. He becomes more of a sedate, more of a calm person, where his mind is freer to pursue things that are really going to satisfy him on the deepest level. Because a person, like Rabbi Chait once said, you know, you call a person sloppy, you know, all right, so he's insulted. You call a person stupid, now that hits him at the core. That's the worst type of insult, because that's what a person values the most. He knows that his mind is really who he is. When you say I, it's my mind. So you insult the way I dress, or how I dress, or what I eat, one thing. You tell me that I'm stupid, now you're hitting the person where he knows that's the essential part. And if a person's not satisfying that in his life, so that's going to be, it's not going to be offering him the deepest, the richest type of an existence. So there are rules across the board that Torah complies with that will give and engender, you know, the most satisfying life. But I agree with you, Doug. I'm not disagreeing with your findings. It's just that we have to be careful not to call something Jewish when it's not. Maybe the guy's a Jew and he's religious, but the way he's living his life is not in the Torah philosophy, so he's not a happy person.
Right, I agree. And may I just say something? I was watching TV for a short time last night, and I was admiring Timothy Dolan. What a beautiful human being he is. What a beautiful person he is. What his philosophy must be. I mean, everybody loves him, and he seems to be giving love out to everyone. And, I mean, he's not Jewish, but he's a godly person. He's following the philosophy of God, Hashem. There's no two ways about it, as far as from what we see.
Okay.
Can't deny that.
Doug, do any of these people who are very happy, do they violate the most basic Noahide laws?
That's a good question, Jim, and I'd have to think that one through. I don't think I can give you a quick answer on that. I need to ponder that a little bit. My guess is, with the exception of one of them, probably not. I think the one about eating the limb of a living animal would never occur to somebody who wasn't schooled in Torah matters.
Right.
But I don't think that probably affects their happiness, because it's completely, I would think it would be completely outside their intellectual radar screen.
Right, but Doug, wouldn't you agree, though, with the principles that if a person is complying with his nature, that he'd be happiest? And if the Torah is all about following what's best for a person, so it should lead to happiness? No, he's not saying that it's an all or nothing thing. I mean, to say that the more a person is following that's in line with perfection, and God knows the human being best, so that's going to add. Now, like I said earlier, you can have people that are very barbaric in nature, And, you know, by law, they should have a very, you know, tumultuous life. They should be aggravated a lot of the time, and their emotions are, you know, hitting erratic extremes. But that doesn't mean that at a meal for a few hours with friends that they're not going to really sense, you know, pleasure. But let's say a person then starts controlling his diet and has, throughout the day, has to now start gauging what he's doing when it comes to the appetitive drive. So that's now going to have more of an effect where his mind is now being engaged to a greater extent during the day. And I can only see that as benefiting the person. He's keeping his emotions more at bay. He's not, you know, completely denying his emotions. He can enjoy meat. He can enjoy his wine. But if he's doing it in a manner where it's more under the control of his intelligence, so then he's not going to end up getting blasted or drunk or sick because he overdid it. And he's also going to, his mind will be more engaged throughout his life. That's going to help him train himself to be more obedient to his intelligence. Now, what that effect will have is next month when he has to make a decision, he's not going to be that erratic or barbaric type of emotionally riveted person anymore. Now, after months and months of observing kosher laws, that will have an effect where he's more tame. Now he might have a greater amount of patience in dealing with another area of his life. So that can contribute. It's the same thing with the sexual. If a person is not following the laws of the Jewish laws with a certain limit on a sexual activity, so then there could be unrestrained intercourse that he has, and what that can end up doing is that he may get bored with his partner. But if there's a certain restraint, and that can and I heard this from a number of people. They said that having the laws where there was a restriction once a month, so then after that 2-week period or 10-day period, whatever it was, that they were not physically in contact with their spouse, it rejuvenated, you know, the romantic element, and that built up anticipation, and it became like the glue of the relationship. So without it, so, you know, a person has a certain lifestyle, but with it, it now can help in terms of the actual relationship. A very big component of the person's happiness is the relationship that he has with a spouse. So, you know, we have to look at it in the, you know, really carefully and fully, completely. But, you know, to simply say that, you know, a person won't be losing much happiness if he doesn't keep kosher, so we have to see, is that really true? Let's see how it plays out. Let's see what the effect will have on the person. Some are going to be more subtle. Some will be, I think, more, like in the case of the sexual, I think that's much more pronounced, I think much more agreeable, that when people do have unrestrained activity, so then they do become bored. I mean, you're constantly seeing these cases in Hollywood, the most beautiful people who marry each other, divorce, constant. Why is that? I mean, one beautiful person is marrying another beautiful person. You think that they have everything that they want. But something's missing, evidently. Something is not there, which is creating a continued interest by both parties. A boredom sets in. Or they get used to it. Or because there's no control over how you speak to each other and respect, you know, all these different laws that the Torah has. So then there's a certain amount of abuse, a certain amount of disrespect, and then one person leaves. I'm sure there's many more examples that we can go through. But I think that might, you know, just give some insight as to how these things are going to add. Like I said, it's not all or nothing. You can have a complete barbaric person that at a certain moment, hey, the guy just won the lottery. Great, fantastic. I run through the story, a guy won the lottery, and then he had money, this and that. His daughter died on drugs, some problem with his brother-in-law, this and that. And then at the end of the day, he said, you know, I wish I never won that ticket. Because there was no real control in terms of how they're going to use the money. There was no real intelligence applied. So the money itself was ended up to be like a time bomb. So you think it has, you know, there's more to it. But I think what, you know, King Solomon is saying here that, you know, if we've discovered everything, meaning the end of the matter, after we've looked at all, I think, the main areas, and that's what I think he's talking about, of course, because, like he said in 12:12, you can't cover everything, you can't write everything down. It's just too many cases, it's too many points. But the broad strokes, I think, is what he's saying. The end of the matter, meaning now that we've really discussed it, we've looked at all the different issues, what happiness, money, so on, anger, you know, the main components, the main attitudes, the main ambitions, immortality fantasy, you know, all these different areas, accomplishment, he went through them all. But interestingly, the first argument he gives is based on experience, meaning what we discovered throughout the book. That's what he says in 12:13. We've discovered everything, and you know, getting back to how we started, that they don't think that the two worlds, the world of the religion and the world of nature, and I could find an alternative path to happiness. Nope. We went through it, and we basically saw there's problems in trying to, you know, chart out your own subjective path to happiness. Right? It's riveted with issues, and that's what the book was showing. But if that's not sufficient, he concludes his book by saying, he reminding a person that the person has to also be warned that God will take you to judgment. He's giving a person one other angle to try to help a person live properly, because you are going to be judged. And that's how we conclude the book. And that's 12:14, where he says, all the matters God will bring to judgment. And everything, even if it's hidden, whether it's good or whether it's evil. So he brings this in order to address the person that still is hesitant. So he brings in the fear factor. He brings in the warning that, listen, the person, everybody dies. And there's going to be a judgment that you're brought to. So this alone is a good reasoning that you should live properly. He's trying to show you, just in terms of reality, your actual experience will be better, and we've tried this, and that's what 12:13 is. But 12:14, he's trying to give you in terms of an authoritative view. Everybody passes away. Everybody's going to be coming to the judgment. God created us all, and he gave us a system, and there is responsibility. So he brings that in at the end, too. I mean, he's really trying to help a person live properly, whether it's for the best reason or whether it's for just the fear factor.
Grandma?
Yes?
I know we're close to time and we could cover this next week, but I wanted to really raise the question.
Yes, yeah.
So in my version, they have a commentary that the Targum paraphrases this and says, for every deed God will bring to the great judgment day, and he is destined to publicize the matter that is hidden from mankind, whether good or bad. What's troubling me about this, particularly at the very end, because it's clearly a threat, is the Torah teaches, as I understand it, that embarrassing another person publicly is one of the worst things you can do.
Yes.
It appears that King Solomon is turning around and saying, and if you don't do all this, God is going to turn around and embarrass you publicly. And so how can it be that God would do something that he is strongly commanded us not to do?
Well, it can't be public, because the person is dead at this point. So it seems to be that he'll inform the person. He's going to make each man know publicly, means God's going to bring it to you. Once you're dead, he's now going to bring to you. He says in the Targum you're talking about, right? That, let me just see where the beginning is.
Yeah, it is the Targum.
Yeah, he says, where does your Dalet start? Oh, here it is. Yeah, he says, however, all matters God will bring to judgment, to the great judgment, and he will eventually make it known on all the walkings of all men. I mean, it seems to be he's saying he's going to show it to you, but there's nobody else around. It's just, you know, judgment is between you and God. So there's no, you know, public humiliation here.
And to whom is he making
to the person, each person, when they pass away. He'll show him, and this is what your judgment is based on. You'll agree to it, because he'll remind you of all that you've done, good or bad. But of course, he's not going to. There's no need to humiliate a person publicly. There's no objective in that. But clear, since he's dead, there can't be public humiliation. I mean, so make it known to the person. So, all right, so I know you have a class, so what we'll do is we can continue next week, and I want to just go through the commentaries on these, and then just flesh out our discussion, too, in terms of, you know, coming to the conclusion that he came to, why King Solomon was so convinced of this, because, like, you know, Doug's question and Jim and your question, so let's try to make it so we're satisfied with the conclusion. It shouldn't be force-fed. It should be that we understand where he's coming from, at least, and why he made this conclusion. All right?
Okay, thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody, so we'll pick up next week, and hopefully we'll get all the commentaries on this. I'm going to do Rashi, Sforno, and Ibn Ezra next week, all right?
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, so have a good week, everybody.